you know, we are blind on this issue. You know, the Holocaust was a horrifying incident in the 20th century, and the Germans took an enormous rap for that, as they should have. But fundamentalist Islam, the Catholic Church, have population policies in place which shove more people into disease, degradation, and early death every year than suffered under the Holocaust. And the people who represent these points of view fly around in 747s and are joyously received by democratic governments, and everybody thinks this is a fine thing. This is a collapse of moral perception of staggering proportions. Who is causing the misery and the dislocation in the third world? Well, it's these institutions which, since they get their directions directly from divinity, feel no constraint to adjust their policies. But until we address this particular part of our political problem, I think the forward progress of technology will continue, but the level of misery for vast numbers of people throughout the world will rise. And this is something we all turn a blind eye to. This is the part of my spiel that most often gets people walking out on me. Because usually I end it by calling for hanging the Pope. Usually I then discover who is no longer amused by the Terrence McKenna show. Certainly the Pope. But how do we square this? You know, how do we square our own connivance in these incredibly dehumanizing policies, which make it very, very difficult to offer hope to people in the third world? There may not be much left to be addressed in the physical world. In other words, perhaps through nanotechnology we can abandon agriculture and feed China out of matter compilers by turning seawater into rice. That's a possibility. But until we eliminate the poverty and overpopulation in the third world, our entire planetary agenda is going to be under a dark cloud of moral obligation.
Yeah. That makes me want to ask the question, though, is the problem population or is the problem consumption? Like a middle
yes.
China we can't afford. Yes.
It's both. It's both. It seems to me, you know, equality of life is the value to be maximized. And I don't know what the carrying capacity of the Earth is, especially in the light of nanotechnological schemes that would allow us to abandon agriculture and still feed everyone. But until the quality of life issue is addressed for the least among us, it seems to me there's a moral obligation to feel that the political task is still undone.
There's a pun that, in fact, Ron and I were passing forth on the telephone the other day, and we basically said that the planet has contracted a fatal case of consumption, which, of course, is the old nickname for tuberculosis. But in a sense, it's really what's going on. So part of that, I mean, in the first world, we actually have to adopt some simplistic approach to finding the quality of life without consumption, you know, the quality of life in interior values of some sort, and a desire to live your life in relationship with the people you love and with your friends, and finding somehow that being enough. The countervailing tendency, and I'm definitely guilty of this, is that I own two computers that were composed of materials that produced a lot of toxins in the environment, blah, 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 blah. And we're entranced with our toys. We all want our new toy. We want our T1 link, da, 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 da. So there's a seduction that all of the technological edifice is offering us, which is flying in the face of all of our good intentions.
There's a name for it.
Affluenza.
But in a sense, I mean, not to make it all things to all men, but virtual reality offers an
right.
opportunity here. Capitalism is not intrinsically flawed. What flaws it is that it insists on fabricating objects out of matter, of which we have a
right.
limited supply.
Right.
If you dealt objects made of light, we have an infinite supply of photons around, and so if you dematerialize value, everyone can live at the St. Regis Hotel and have Vermeers hanging on their walls. I don't know about the chef part, but the dematerialization of the commodity market is probably capitalism's only hope. 40 years ago, it was thought that extraterrestrial industrialism would open the closing loop of the production cycle. Apparently that option has been taken off the menu, at least for the short-term future. But virtual reality can step in here in an insidious way. It already has. If you think of daytime television as a kind of virtual reality, millions of low-awareness lives are just being warehoused in the suburbs where people imbibe this endless infomercial-based environment and congratulate themselves on the splendid quality of life they've achieved. So there are many traps, many pitfalls, contradictions. It's not simple. It is dinner time, however. So let's knock off, and we'll come back this evening here at 8 o'clock. Thank you very much. Session will blend gently into mediated event of some sort. Mark is in charge of that, so I'm not sure, but I'm as interested as I'm sure you are. The early part of the day got most of the issues in play. We seem to be swelling, ever swelling our numbers. Are there issues? We had to end somewhat abruptly at 6 o'clock. How does all this sit with you? Yeah.
I think there was something we talked about at dinner. Can you be happy-go-lucky till the end of time?
You mean, is there some responsibility to gravitas? Is that what you mean?
Is there any legitimate fear, really, to all of this? There might be a fear to all the unknown factors like nanotech and all the good stuff we've been talking about, but is there really anything truly worth fear?
Well, in my experience, not. My fundamental intuition is that it's okay, that somehow the how of the coming to the eschaton is not yet fixed, but that it is on schedule and going to happen is somehow it's a very deep creed. Where the anxiety arises is just in people trying to explain to themselves what is happening. And, you know, people will not live without closure in the unexamined intellectual life. So the world is now so complex, very few people, quote unquote, understand it. But in whatever area that you don't understand it, you generate mythology. Which explains it to you. And so most of us, as the culture becomes more complex, our participation in it becomes more magical, more animistic, more provisional, more mythic. this is both a good and a bad thing. I mean, it leads to cult, which is, I think, a bad thing. In other words, people accept explanations for reality who the only argument for which is that they are explanations for reality. their persuasive force otherwise is zilch. There was another comment here.
Alan, if I can just add to that, the interesting thing about fear, and I think Terrence made the point earlier, is that primates are at their best when they're in the corner. And in fact, if the argument that I've been making over the last couple of days, that we need to revision our own understanding of the universe and change our beliefs and habits appropriately, then in fact perhaps the fear of this gray goo planet and its ilk, all the other demons that can be conjured, can be used as catalysts to change the mind.
Yeah, in other words, you can't go on automatic. So it isn't that kind of carefreeness at the end of time. But on the other hand, I really, you know, there's an Irish toast. May you be alive at the end of the world. Well, I think, you know, that we have a crack at it. And it's just the most fascinating thing. Maybe every age has had the feeling that it stood on the brink of such a transition, but I don't believe that, because we can see the rhetoric of past ages, and you know, their concerns were different. But it certainly seems that somehow our lives have been chosen to be microcosmic summations of macrocosmic processes that have acted themselves out over a long time. And maybe we are just simply dumb lucky to have been born into this moment, but so be it.
Maybe comment on what you think about the eschaton in relationship to Zeno's paradox. I kind of personally tend to think it shows it to be a hoax.
It shows Zeno's paradox to be a hoax, or the eschaton? Well, Zeno's paradox is not a hoax. It's based on a misunderstanding. You all know Zeno's paradox. It's that we have a tortoise which is going from A to B. First it goes half the distance, then it goes half of the distance left, then it goes half the distance left. Because it always has a distance left to traverse, the argument was motion is impossible. But this rests on a simple logical fallacy. What we have here is what's called an infinite series. 1/2 plus 1/4 plus 1/8 plus 1/16. But the sum of that infinite series is not infinity, as the paradox suggests. The sum is 1. Ergo, the problem is solved. It was just a naive stage of human thought. Once you understand that the sum of an infinite series is a finite integer, that's overcome. So no, we will reach the realm of the densely packed at a certain moment in historical time. It's strange that this is the faith of Western religion has always been this irrational insistence that God would enter history. It's a barely languageable notion. I mean, when you compare it to the nihilism of Buddhism and the cyclical thinking of Hinduism, these seem like very natural topological configurations of the metaphysical impulse. But the Western thing, you know, that man, that God becomes man and enters history and redeems the past, I mean, it's pulp science fiction, and yet archetypically maintained for thousands of years as a primary insight about the structure of reality. And because the Western methodologies and intellectual toolkit had sharper edges than its neighbors, it's in a way coming to pass.
It's a Middle Eastern import, actually, isn't it?
Yes.
You mean that it comes from the it comes from the Arabs, but via Neoplatonists, and hence from the late phase of Platonic thinking. So it has a provenance, it has a lineage, yes.
If the grand project of technology is the deconstruction of reality, is it also deconstructing culture or creating a new culture, and what kind of cultural wars can you expect if that is the case?
Well, I think it is deconstructing culture. I go back to the French sociologist Jacques Ellul. I quote nearly every time I speak his statement, there are no political solutions, only technological ones. The rest is propaganda. And in the middle 50s, he wrote a book explaining what he meant by all these terms. Technology is like a drug in that it dissolves these boundaries that are so very, very carefully constructed and maintained by cultural values. So, you know, McLuhan said no technology in history was ever put in place with even a partial appreciation of its consequences. Technologies can make people money, so people are seduced by them away from cultural values and then become the carriers of these transformative technological memes that always pose problems for the culture in which they arise. And I think culture is a self-imposed form of fascism, that cultural rules are always give us a smaller version of humanity than humanity in fact is. In other words, you're inside a culture that tells you monogamous marriage is the highest ideal. Well, so then all the other humanly well-tested possibilities are left out because that particular cultural software doesn't support that particular behavior. So culture is something infantile. It's pre-adolescent. It's something which a civilized society would quietly do away with, I think. Did you want to say? Huh?
No one does away with it. Everybody clings to it. We do it in our own way.
Well, you can strive for cosmopolitanity. You know, if you travel, if you take drugs, if you have an affair with the Albanian ambassador's daughter, and if you do sophisticated things, you can mitigate against it. But yeah, to the degree that you slow down and speak one local language and trade in one intellectual currency and stay in one place, it closes back over you again. Provincialism. That's why I'm such a booster for Manhattan. Because I think, you know, as urban design goes, that's the best designed immunization program against provincialism ever dreamed up. And the internet is another. You know, you're in some village somewhere defined by its values, you jack into the World Wide Web, and suddenly the human galaxy of values is accessible. You want to talk about any of this, Mark, or anything else?
I just want to say that the question that you just asked is word for word repeated in my notes, so you could come over and take a look at it. Right, it was a little bit airy hearing that. Why don't I start rapping a little bit?
Yeah.
In the afternoon, in our afternoon nightmares, I did my very best to invoke a few demons. I'll invoke one more before I work to exorcise them. There's a rap that I haven't given in a long time because it requires props that I don't have. And those of you who know what props will blush because you know what props I'm talking about. And I gave the talk in public a few years ago. In fact, at the Exploratorium in the McBean Theater. And it was a talk about sex in VR. So I was on a panel with a couple of other people, and I don't really know how I got onto this panel about sex in VR because I've never had any. Yes. And one way or another, I ended up on this panel, and I came onto the panel, and I had a paper bag. And in the paper bag, with the paper bag on the stage, so imagine that I have a paper bag here. And I started to tell a story, and I said the year is 1997. That's coming past, it was years ago. So let's say the year is 2001, and I've just come back with the good guys, and I've got a bag full of goodies. And I pull out a head-mounted display and say, look, this is the latest model, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I pull out a Sony PlayStation and say, look, this is the latest model, da-da-da-da-da. And then I pull out a dildo. And I say, oh, this is the latest model. It's got all the appropriate sensors in it, da-da-da-da-da. And I put a condom on it, so it's sitting there, and we have to have clean, safe, virtual sex. And then I pull out a compact disc. And what's really important is the story of the software that's on this compact disc. Because the compact disc software was based on some research that had been done a few years ago when they wired up some yogis to get a sense of their neurophysical states. And the yogis would go into various trance states and they would record the brainwave pattern, and that's very cool. And one of the things that they did is they got two yogis who studied Tantra in there who just went at it for 24 hours straight and could have gone longer, but they ran out of disc space. Fine. Well, the disk drives go off to some folks in Bangalore, a bunch of PhDs, graduates of Indian universities, who sit and work on understanding the neurologic patterns involved in this state of consciousness. Now, the interesting thing about the head-mounted display that I've purchased is that the head-mounted display itself is not just a normal HMD, but in fact is equipped with sensors, so it can not only project images, but it's capable of reading my brainwave patterns to some degree.
Can you talk a little louder?
Sorry. The head-mounted display is capable of reading my brainwave patterns, at least sensorially, and the PlayStation has got the appropriate inputs for it. And the Indian PhDs look at this and they build some neural net software and they figure out how, in theory anyway, to produce, by using a set of conditioned inputs with the dildo and the head-mounted display, a brainwave state that's analogous to the state that's being produced by the tantric yogis. And again, this relates to what I was talking about bodies and boundaries this morning, that as we move technologies to permeability, to induce particular types of states is becoming something that's increasingly easier. And after a while, the PhDs crack the problem and they can produce the state in 75% of the test subjects, who are all very happy people indeed. So I posited this technological construction and slapped it on stage and said, okay, I'm going to pop this thing on. And the next question I need to ask is, will I be able to turn it off? Because tantric sex by its nature is a high state of sexual excitation and pleasure that does not achieve any functional resolution. Mm-hmm. You don't have to terminate it. There's no orgasm. And of course, we've all heard horror stories about people who are in tantra before they can deal with the energies raised, short out like light bulbs in a high voltage kind. And so we have to also wonder, and that's the last of the demons I'll put on the table. These are the other kinds of demons that we can invoke. It's not just the gray goo. It's something that is in some ways the equivalent of heroin. And these are the entire array. If I put all the goods out on the table, you have to see the good and the bad. And so we have to consider very carefully when we're working on things like this, is this the direction we want to go in? So intent becomes a very important issue, particularly in areas where the natural boundaries of the body are being bridged in particularly mediated ways. All right. Now we're going to say goodbye to the demons. Actually, do you want to take it for a little while?
Well, I'll just add to what you said. I mean, you implied the subject of addiction because of these high states of erotic consciousness that could be machine engendered. Earlier in the day, we talked about how in a world with a perfected VR toolbox, what is really being offered to people is a kind of godhood, a kind of ability to build, live in, control, and extrapolate fantasies on very, very large scales. So that also sounds very addictive. That's the most addictive thing one can imagine, short perhaps of continuous tantric orgasm. And when you write the software that allows you to do both at once, there you have
it. There you go.
So I wonder to what degree technology has always had this ability to hook us. The bibliophile is an interesting figure. People obsessed by books, by possessing books, buying books. As soon as books were invented, there were people who fell in love with them. And I think in the case of these new immersive technologies, it's almost overwhelmingly certain that our relationship to them will be like that of a relationship to a drug. Look at television. I mean, if television were heroin, we would have long ago written off Western civilization. Imagine if heroin had, if people had begun using heroin 8 hours a day at the end of World War II and had it expand to the entire population. We don't think of television as a drug because it's inconvenient to do so, but the impact it's had on people's lives and the way in which it has dumbed them down and enslaved them to a more limited set of behavioral responses, which is what a drug does. It draws you in very tightly around its orbit. All occurs very dramatically in the case of TV. So I don't know what we can do about that. The simple science of pharmacology, leave alone all this other high-flown technical stuff, is on the brink of producing an endless cornucopia of very target-specific drugs. Viagra is a perfect example. Prozac is another. There will be many more of these kinds of mood-enhancing, performance-enhancing, social skill-enhancing, memory-enhancing, pharmacological options, all of which leads to the idea of modification of ordinary habits by relationships to substances and sources of stimulation.
Then we need to become used to bliss.
Yes, we have to become very sophisticated about bliss and know how to choose our castles in the air with care, because you're going to have to live in those castles in the air. I had a castles in the air vision the other night. I was sitting gazing into space and the phrase came to me just out of the blue, nanoelectric aerogel. And I said, that's it! It's this sort of soap-sudsy stuff that has nano circuitry grown all over it, and you grow it in the stratosphere, and it moves around, and everybody is uploaded into it. So we don't have to touch the earth anymore, and we begin a migration of intelligence into the stratospheric levels of the planet, where there's enough ambient high energy to keep these aerogel environments both airborne and moving around the planet and electrified by static electricity to keep the modems running.
Okay.
Yeah.
An unscheduled tour of the numinous. And Terrence and I left this part of the program relatively free, and I really want to use this part of the program, even though we've been dallying with technology, I think, in the first part, to get back, although I'm going to talk about technology, this part's really going to be more talking about intent, and particularly the intent where it intersects the artistic intent. And the first person I'm going to talk about is a Canadian artist that I've become very good friends with, a woman by the name of Char Davies. And some of you who are familiar with my work are familiar with the fact that I've written about her work extensively. Char's had a very interesting career because when she was educated as a fine art painter. When she was in her 20s, she experienced a moment of the numinous, completely unaided by any psychedelics, but had an experience when lying in a field in the southeastern part of Ontario, where she grew up, that she felt a moment as if the boundaries between the field and the land around her and her own being had collapsed, and that there was a unity, there was a profound unity, that the world and the forest and the land were literally inside of her. And this became, in a sense, the object of her own vision. It became something that she chose to pursue with her own artistic intent. And she began to paint. And so she would paint forests, and she'd paint forest scenes that had a particular quality to them. People saw it as being almost a very spiritual quality in her painting, without being completely sort of explicit. They had an inner beauty. Things happen. She moves to Montreal, and she ends up being one of the founders of a company that was called Soft Image. Soft Image was the first computer graphics, 3D computer graphics software company. And over the years, she worked at Soft Image. In the beginning, it was a startup, so she did what she needed to. She wrote the manuals. She did some marketing. They got some financing. And the software became the software that's used in most films today for computer graphics. But she never left her artistic intent, and so when they were working on the software, she would play with it, in part to test it, but in part to see if her own sensibilities of the world, as she understood them as a painter, could be represented in this medium. And so she'd say, why can't I do this? Why can't I make this object look translucent? Why can't I make it look translucent and color it with different light sources? And in part, the reason that we can see Titanic and Armageddon on the big screen and have them be believable is because somewhere back there, there was an artist who was measuring everything against an interior sense of fidelity and making things look real. Well, the company grows up. It's a $100 million company, and she is allowed then to move and become her own role, director of visual research, which doesn't really mean anything. It means she can do as she pleases because the company's been a success, so she has free time. And the first thing that she did was design something that she called a light box, which could take a static image because, in fact, unless you're using cinema film at that point in time, the only way you could get a 3D graphics image was to print it on a sheet of paper. In this case, she did it on a sheet of cellulose. And she would create these constructions that looked like huge, organic, almost gel-like fans floating in the seawater with light suffused in them. And no one in the world of computer graphics had ever seen anything come out of a computer that looked so organic and looked like it had grown, really almost like a photograph. But this was the beginning of her quest, using now technology as a means to represent. And she did a series of these, won some awards. They've been shown at major art festivals, at SIGGRAPH, things like this. And she began to establish a reputation. Well, time goes on, and as we know, computers get faster and stronger and better. And she began to really have a desire to have one of these works be real. She's making these works in the sense that they're three-dimensional, but she can't show them to people that way. But all of a sudden, graphic supercomputers are available, and they're only a few $100,000, and there are several of them all across the building she's working in, because this is the place where they make the software for the movies. And so she starts on another project, and she decides she's going to make one of these light boxes that she can walk into. And now she's confronted not just with the artistic intent, but she's also confronted with the reality of immersion in the virtual world. And she took a look at immersion as it was understood in the early 1990s. And she saw that most people moved in the virtual world by one of two mechanisms, one of which was using the data glove and pointing in the virtual world, which is, in fact, not particularly intuitive, somewhat cumbersome, and actually, if you leave your arm out here for a while, it gets tired. It's just a biological reality. The second one of which was the joystick, and she never thought the joystick was natural, and I remarked to her one day, that's because you're not a man. It's the most natural... It's the most natural movement in the world to a man, and she laughed. And I actually do think there's some reality to that. She was looking for an interface, and she was looking for an interface that could bring the physical reality of the body into cyberspace. Well, it was just the point in her life when she was learning how to scuba dive. Now, for those of you who don't, and I don't, but I've heard a lot of description of it, a scuba diver maneuvers in the boundless three-dimensional space underneath the water. So you think about it, humans really only move in two dimensions, right? We really only move about, we don't move up and down. But a diver moves in three dimensions by controlling the buoyancy of their body, and they control the buoyancy of their body by controlling the amount of air in their lungs. As you inflate your chest with air, your buoyancy changes to be less than water and you rise, and as you exhale, you fall. And so she constructed not a trillion-dollar apparatus, but a simple band that goes around your chest that simply measures your chest extension. It's $5 in components. And poof, all of a sudden, you've invented an interface to the virtual world that isn't based on anything that's unnatural, but on the most innate of all actions, which is breathing. So that in the virtual world that she created to float up, you go, and you rise gently. And to float down, you exhale. To move forward, you lean gently forward. To move backward, you lean gently backward and side to side. The power that this had was to bring the embodied being into the virtual world, because you cannot leave your body behind inside of her work. Your body is intimate, even though it is not represented. Your body is intimately present inside the work. And so the drive to sort of tear behind and leave the meat down on Earth as you explore the wilds of cyberspace, was completely circumvented. It was short-circuited, because what it showed was that the presence of the body made cyberspace more effective, more powerful, more seductive. Well, there's the interface, but what did she put inside of it? What she chose to do in this work was to create an evocation of the natural world. And she created a piece that's called Osmos, which is the French word for osmosis, to flow between. And in this world, or actually a collection of worlds, there are 10 different spaces, and the main space has a large tree that's simply represented. And you can flow around this tree, you can flow up into the leaves of this tree, you can flow into a single leaf of a tree, and particle systems will animate beams of light representing perhaps the flows of energy within a single leaf of the tree. You can float over to a glade, you can flow down a brook, you can fall into beneath the surface of the earth and see the strata of rocks and stones that are underneath. Now the thing of it is that as a painter, she understood that in fact we do not see the real world as a collection of bright neon hard-edged objects. That in fact the scientific evocation of the virtual world as being a collection of objects that are black, burped up from the void, sitting there and glowing, has nothing to do with our own real experience. So every single object in Osmos, and there are 5,000 of them or something, are transparent to different degrees. So that the effect that you get as you look at any of the objects in this world is indistinct, it's indeterminate. Everything is between, it's liminal in an absolute sense. Well, people really liked the work when she was testing it. And it had set a gallery date. It was going to be shown at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Montreal, which is, in fact, where I saw it a few weeks later. People would go into the system. They'd cruise around. Now, imagine they're wearing a head-mounted display, quite a large one, and it's about 20 pounds, and that places a considerable torque on the neck. and you also sweat a lot, and it's sort of stuffy, and people just wouldn't get out of it. Because what they were seeing and what they were experiencing was so unique. And it wasn't a silent world, and I want to stress this, that in fact the sound was there, and the sound was a male and a female human voice that was processed any number of different ways, and it wasn't pre-planned. It was based on where you were and what you were doing. So you'd hear a chorus of different voices and sounds as you passed through the world doing different things. We're a week away from the exhibition day, and on average, people have been spending 40 minutes in the work. Well, to show a work like this in a gallery, and you only have one supercomputer and one head-mounted display, you need to be able to get people in and out at 15-minute intervals. 5 minutes to get them in, 15 minutes in it, 5 minutes to get the next person in. You can do three people an hour that way. So she needed to create an artificial end. And so what she did is that after about 14 and a half minutes, you find yourself now gently floating above the main world of the single tree in the glade, and the world itself is encased in a partially translucent crystalline sphere, and you pull away from it into blackness. That's when people started coming out of the work crying. People started to write in the book that they weren't sure they were afraid of death anymore, that this reminded them of something nothing so much as a near-death experience. That in fact this longing and this leaving of the world was inducing a state that could really only be called profoundly religious. And it's funny because when I tell some people this, they laugh as if it were impossible for a work of electronic art or a work of virtual art to induce this response in people. But then I ask them, if you go into Chartres Cathedral, if you go into Notre Dame, don't you then experience this sort of opening? Whether or not you believe the creed, the space itself is constructed in such a way that it really has this profound effect on you. And I think what Char has done in that work is really find some way to an opening to something that's inside of us, something that's very evocative of us, evocative to us, of the sacred. And that wasn't her intent. It's a byproduct of her artistic vision. She took a break because that was a lot of work. She got a lot of flack from the electronic art community because the old school in electronic art thinks that if it's pretty, it's not valuable. If it's not making a statement about the war in Bosnia, it's worthless. If it's not politically strident, it's pointless. She didn't care. She had achieved her goals. And people were still reporting the intense beauty of the work if you go and read her logbooks from people who write their comments after they'd been in. But Osmos was a period of longing for her. She'd been in a very long-term relationship. Her life was just basically on the rocks at the time, and so the work was emotionally evocative of this. 2 years later, she comes back, and she's in a very different frame of mind. And she realizes that what she wants to do is start to use this mechanism and this interface to explore a joyous experience. And she went into the lab for another year. And just last month, at the National Gallery in Canada, a successor work, I think of them as complements, was created called Ephemere, the ephemera or ephemeral. And this work uses precisely the same interface, so you are embodied in the work, but the subject, the content, is entirely different. When you enter it, you see a sea of stars, and these stars begin to move and flow down, and as they do, the light rises on what looks like nothing so much as an antique Chinese watercolor. Trees, almost as single straight lines, falling down to a glade that's covered in snow, and the stars become falling snowflakes. And you can stay in this environment, and as time passes, the sun rises and sets, the moon rises and sets, and then as the sun rises in the next day, the only way I can describe it is as if Monet's God has been loosed in the world, because all of a sudden the forest floor becomes this writhing sea of purple and yellow, and all the colors the trees and living things are before the chlorophyll comes alive in them. And you look up into the trees and you see these great sheets of color waving around. And it's not what a forest looks like, it's what a forest feels like. And she says her influence is Joseph Turner, who's the great oil painter from the last century, and the fact that his bold strokes of color that are all very indistinct and still incredibly evocative powered her in this environment. And you can follow this forest through its four seasons, but you can also allow yourself to drop and find yourself in the strata underneath this forest. And the strata underneath this forest are tectonic plates that are in motion slowly. And if you look into the plates themselves, into the rocks and stones, they become active. Because now, rather than just the passive viewing of an experience she's created, she's allowed you to interact with it, not by reaching out and touching, but simply by the joy of your gaze. And as you look into an object, it may change in front of you. You might look into a rock and see the forest inside it, and all of a sudden find that your world has become the forest inside this rock. And you can travel further down. And as you travel further down, you now reach the final substructure of Aphemere, which is a body. It's not necessarily a human body, but it's a body. It's got blood, it's got bones, and it's got sinew, and they're all in motion. And of course, because this has the same constraints as the previous work, this work has to have an end.